All right. So just to remind you where we stopped last time, we derived these two wave equations for the vector and scalar potentials, converted the eight partial differential equations, first order, which represent Maxwell's equations, to four partial differential equations for A and Phi. We're going to tackle solving these, but I need to first discuss just a few technical points. First one is, you've probably all learned this as undergraduates, but you have to be careful with del squared A, that you can't just sort of say, oh, I'm going to write A in spherical coordinates, you know, AR, R hat, plus A phi, phi hat, plus A theta, theta hat, and then write del squared in spherical coordinates and march ahead. This gets complicated, and the reason it gets complicated is because those unit vectors are themselves functions of R, theta, and phi. So the safest way I usually like to think about this del squared A is to think of it in Cartesian coordinates. And then you can have del squared of each component, for instance, that. And that's fine. And you can write del squared. If you've written the vector in Cartesian coordinates, you can write del squared in any coordinates that you like. So you could write this del squared in spherical coordinates if it's applied to A in Cartesian coordinates. Just something that probably is just a reminder for you. So the goal was partly about going to potentials. Actually, there are a couple of reasons why it's desirable to go to potentials. One is that it eliminates some of the ambiguity or maybe redundancy that's inherent in Maxwell's equations. Another reason is, even though we have the Lorentz force, it depends on the fields rather than the potentials. Once we go to quantum mechanics, that uses the potentials normally. In the standard ways, quantum mechanics introduces electromagnetic fields into the equations, the Schrödinger equation. And so that's another reason why we're often really especially interested in the potentials. So this brings us to tackling some remaining ambiguity, which goes under the name of gauge choices. That the potentials themselves are not unique. There are different selections we could make for A and Phi, which will give the same E and B fields. So let's discuss this, and this leads to making use of this actually to simplify the equations. So in particular, note that B is unchanged, if we make a change A to A plus the gradient of an arbitrary scalar function. Let's call this new vector potential A prime. That we've decided to take our old A, we've added a scalar potential, sorry, the gradient of a scalar, and made a new different vector potential. This gives the exact same magnetic field, However, E would change unless we make a parallel change phi to phi minus d lambda dt, which we could call phi prime. And then these new potentials, A prime and phi prime, would give the exact same electric and magnetic fields. So we can make use of this and simplify our two inhomogeneous partial differential equations for the potentials and put them in a little simpler form. And so in particular, we will usually, in this course, and also most of the time next semester, choose the gauge. Choosing lambda here basically means choosing the gauge. In other words, making some standard choice for the vector potentials. And we'll usually choose it so A and phi obey what's known as the Lorentz condition. Which is del dot A plus 1 over C squared d phi dt is 0. And you can see why one might want to do that. That eliminates this whole ugly looking term and gives much simpler equations, and in particular, they will look very similar and symmetrical. So in particular, this changes our wave equations, inhomogeneous wave equations, to del squared phi minus 1 over c squared d squared phi dt squared is minus rho over epsilon naught, and del squared A minus 1 over c squared d squared phi, A dt squared is minus mu naught J. We're still just doing Maxwell's equations with no media here. We'll worry about media later. So these are relevant to the Maxwell's equations in vacuum. So these are the key equations, very beautiful and symmetrical looking, that make waves propagate at the speed of light, and that we'll spend a fair amount of time solving. There is another gauge that's used fairly often, especially in some special applications. Some of the math gets easier for some types of problems. If you work in a different gauge, that's called the Coulomb gauge. Where del dot A is set to 0. Wow. Del dot A. And that also simplifies some of the equations, but in a different way, and makes them look quite non-symmetrical. This gauge is also sometimes called the radiation gauge or for the transverse gauge. And I should write the equations that you get in the Coulomb gauge. And the physics can look rather different in the different gauges. Something to kind of be on the alert for. So for instance, now del squared phi is simply minus rho over epsilon naught, even when you have time dependence. And the Coulomb gauge looks the same as before, as what we had in electrostatics. And we already know the solution to that, right? When there are no boundaries, right? We could just right away invoke Feynman's dictum. The same equations have the same solutions. And charge density depends on time. You can simply integrate over the instantaneous charge density, and it will be instantaneously felt in the potential, no matter how far away the observation point is from the potential, which seems a little surprising because we think information should travel at the speed of light. Shaking a charge here would normally not change a field over here at the exact same time. It would take that distance over the speed of light to change it. And in fact, it's not easy to prove this. It's a homework problem in Jackson that I once assigned and then failed to solve it myself. But you can prove, supposedly, that the fields don't change. But it's pretty tricky proof. The vector potential equation is not made much simpler. It's actually a little more ugly, in my opinion. In the Coulomb gauge, looks like del squared A minus 1 over C squared D squared A dt squared is minus mu naught J plus now 1 over C squared the gradient of d phi dt, which I don't find as beautiful. And that's one price you pay if you work in the Coulomb gauge. You have to deal with this somewhat more ugly looking equation. There is something pointed out in Jackson that's worth noting, not just for here, but any time you're going to work with any vector field in any context, that any vector field, pick your favorite one, can be decomposed or written as a sum of two fields, one of which is called longitudinal vector field, let's pick a vector field, let's pick J in this case, a longitudinal term obeys curl of J L. JL is my longitudinal term. It obeys curl equals zero. And plus a transverse term, JT, that obeys del dot JT is zero. It's an interesting theorem that you can take any vector field and find some part of it that has no curl, no twisting. You can think of it longitudinal and transverse vector field component that has no divergence. This is discussed more on Jackson, page 242, so you might take a look at that. But one thing that they show that I'm not going to prove, but I'll maybe tell you because it's an interesting factoid, is that you can prove that 1 over c squared, the gradient of d phi dt, is in fact equal to mu naught times the longitudinal part of the current density j. And what that means is that this ugly-ish looking equation simply becomes minus mu naught, the transverse part of the current density, is what's equal to del squared a minus 1 over c squared. So in that language, if you can separate out the current density into a transverse and a longitudinal part, then actually the vector potential equation just looks just as nice as we had over here. Okay. You know, it seems like it's been so long. So too long since we've derived a Green's function. So by golly, it's time to do it again.
Do they what? The methods that you told us, like.
We will use some of those methods, yeah. I mean, the wave equation is one of the most important partial differential equations you'll see in your lifetimes. So the Green's function for that equation is also important. So all of these equations, all four of the equations, like in the Lorentz gauge, obey an equation of the following form. And so I'll just write a generic one, and you could regard this as applying to any of the Cartesian components of A or to phi, if we're in the Lorentz gauge. They all look like del squared minus 1 over c squared dt squared. Some function, I'll pick a scalar function psi now. I don't mean wave function, just a general scalar function depending on position and time. And I'll write the inhomogeneity in this equation as minus 4 pi f of xt, right? So that might be a current or it might be a component of the vector of the current density. So f of xt in this equation is some known specified source, typically. It's a charge. You're going to jiggle a charge. That's a charge. And it's also a current. If I'm moving a charge around, that's also a current. So this is going to create the potential over here at some time. And that's what this equation describes. So this is, as I said, it's linear. It's inhomogeneous. You might correct your notes. In a moment of temporary insanity, I wrote in the notes that it's homogeneous. But it really is inhomogeneous. And so it's solvable by Green's function methods. And we will do that. So let's write the equation for the Green's function. Now it's a four-dimensional Green's function. Guess we haven't encountered such an object yet. Depends on an observation point at an observation time t, and it depends on a source position x prime at a source time where something happened in the source at time t prime. And this all equals minus 4 pi delta x minus x prime delta t minus t prime. So, after we've solved it, let me just skip ahead a little bit. After we know this g, of course, then we can solve our original wave equation, our original inhomogeneous partial differential equation, using linearity, right? We're going to add up all of the source terms, propagate them with the Green's function to an observation point. Will look something like this, g of x t, x prime t prime, times the inhomogeneity, f of x prime t prime, integrate over position prime, time prime. This will tell you the psi in our original PDE that is generated by the inhomogeneity. Now, this is not the most general solution. You could also have a homogeneous solution of the equation where the right-hand side is zero. Okay, what does that mean physically? That means we have charges, rho j here, at t prime and x prime, it's going to be sending out waves over here to some observation point p. Okay, the first term describes these waves coming out here. But someone has a radio station over here. Beep, 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 beep. And it's sending waves through here. And that's what this term is. Okay, so, oh, I hate it when I drop my chalk. It's so sad. It shatters into a million pieces. I killed my chalk. Okay, so there are a few kind of general things to we want to think about in about this Green's function. I should say that my derivation of the Green's function, it follows Jackson initially, but then we take a right turn and do it, the rest of it pretty different from the textbook. So some of the considerations are as follows. First, only relative times should matter. If I shake a charge now, it'll produce a field sometime later. And that same scenario would happen if I do it this afternoon, right? I'm doing all of this in one Lorentz frame. I've chosen one Lorentz frame to talk about everything. Okay. Later we could talk about Lorentz invariance, and we will next semester. And find solutions in a different frame if we have found the solutions in one frame. But you should always think of Maxwell's equations. They are set up, when you solve them, they are in one inertial reference frame. Okay, so only relative times matter, not absolute times. And that means that we expect, as a consequence, g of xt, x prime, t prime, should actually, could be rewritten as g of x, x prime, t minus t prime, and as a relative time variable instead of an absolute t and an absolute t prime separately. Second point is, which is only true in free space with no boundaries, only relative positions should matter. And that is the Green's function we're going to calculate initially. This is the free space Green's function with no boundaries. So that means a further simplification that this thing I wrote over there, g of x, x prime, t minus t prime, then for this situation in free space with no boundaries, can be also rewritten as g of x minus x prime t minus t prime, which we'll abbreviate as, so there's a vector and a scalar that this Green's function depends on. We'll call the vector capital R, and the scalar we'll call tau for now. And of course, R is that relative distance between an observation point and a source point, and tau is the difference between the observation and the source time. Okay, so, and our equation now can just be regarded as del squared minus 1 over c squared, del r squared minus 1 over c squared, d squared by d tau squared. We can change variables to this now, and we're solving that this is minus 4 pi delta of r delta of tau. now we have a little simplified our work a little bit. Instead of an eight-dimensional quantity, we have now a four-dimensional quantity. So I'm not going to solve this all at once. I'm going to do it kind of in stages. I'm first going to find the time-dependent part of this Green's function. And we can do that by Fourier analysis in the time variable. As follows, we'll write g of r tau as 1 over 2 pi integral minus infinity to infinity over a frequency omega, little omega, e to the minus I omega tau, a function I'll call g of r comma omega. So this is just, as you all know, you can write any function of time. You can rewrite it in Fourier land as a function of omega. It's an equivalent way of writing any function of time, unless you're a mathematician, and then you'll have to do lots of other words. Okay, so let's just plug in to the PDE that I wrote at the bottom right over there. We have, we're going to find an equation for this new g of r omega. So we have del squared minus 1 over c squared d tau squared. In the notes I wrote d squared by dt squared in places instead of d squared by d tau squared. But You know what I mean. G of r tau, plug it in. We've got 1 over 2 pi integral over all frequencies minus infinity to infinity d omega e to the minus I omega tau. And now the del squared part, it just acts on the spatial dependence. And we have an omega squared over c squared that the two time derivatives pull down times this g of r omega, frequency dependent Green's function, we could call that. And now I could plug in, and I will plug in, the Fourier representation of the time Dirac delta function. So that equals, right, minus 4 pi delta of r, delta of tau, which is minus 4 pi delta of r, and then integral minus infinity to infinity of d omega e to the minus I omega tau. Divided by 2 pi. Right? You all know that form of the delta function, I hope, the time delta function. So just equating these two terms, we can see that if this is equal to this, then we will have satisfied the original Green's function. So that has basically recast our four-dimensional PDE, Green's function, in terms of now the problem is to simply find a spatial three-dimensional Green's function, which I'll write this way, del squared plus k squared, the script g of r and omega is minus 4 pi delta of r, which starts to look a little more familiar. It's just an ordinary three-dimensional spatial Green's function. But it's frequency dependent. And of course, k squared is omega squared over c squared here. All right, so we could solve this using any of our methods we've developed so far. I'm going to use the, what did I call it? Method one, I think, where we expand in a complete set in all the coordinates. So we could do this in different ways. Next semester we'll solve that in spherical coordinates. But today I'm just going to use Cartesian, which is a little simpler. Let's pick the following orthonormal set of eigenfunctions of the operator del squared. In Cartesian coordinates. Usually I'll write it minus del squared because then that is a positive definite operator that will have positive eigenvalues. And those eigenfunctions are, I'll call them uk prime of r are 2 pi to the minus 3 halves e to the I k prime dotted r. These are orthonormal in the Dirac delta function sense, and they obey minus del squared u k prime of r is equal to k prime squared uk prime of r, and depends actually on three eigenvalues, kx prime, ky prime, and kz prime. It's also an eigenfunction of that operator. And the completeness, the orthonormality relation says uk prime conjugate of R, UK of R, D cubed R is three-dimensional delta function of K minus K prime. Integrating, of course, to infinity. Okay, so we can do what we did in method one. We can plug in an expansion of this Green's function, the spatial Green's function now, frequency dependent. We can plug in this expansion in terms of the orthonormal complete set, uk prime of r, with constant coefficients. They'll be frequency dependent, of course, but they won't be dependent on space or time. So that looks as follows. Of r omega integral d cubed k prime e to the I k prime dot r over 2 pi to the 3 halves. Now times some unknown function of k prime that depends also on omega. And we have to find that unknown function by plugging it into our now, yeah, here we are, plugging it in here. So plugging in. Get del squared plus k squared acting on this integral d cubed k prime e to the I k prime dot r over 2 pi to the 3 halves a omega of k prime. Go ahead and take this operation inside the integral. The del squared is just going to pull down a minus k prime squared. It acts on the exponential. So that changes the integral to d cubed k prime minus k prime squared plus k squared e to the I k prime dot r over 2 pi to the 3 halves, a omega of k prime. And this has to equal minus 4 pi delta of r, which I can also write in Fourier notation using the completeness. 2 pi to the minus 3 integral d cubed k prime e to the I k prime dot r. Right, that is delta of r, so then we have to multiply that by the minus 4 pi. And just comparing these two expressions, we can just read off what a omega of k prime has to be to make this inequality. And you can check my algebra if you want when you get home, but I claim that leads to a omega of k prime has to equal 4 pi over k prime squared minus k squared 1 over 2 pi to the 3 halves power, which we can now plug in, and we have a formula for our Green's function as an integral, three-dimensional integral. Pi over 2 pi cubed integral over k prime d cubed k prime e to the I k prime dot r over k prime squared minus k squared. Voila, there is our Green's function. It's kind of annoying to have it be a three-dimensional integral, though. Maybe we should evaluate it. I think I will. What? No, I don't think you can type that into Mathematica and get an answer. Not sure it can handle a three-dimensional integral that is not even uniquely defined. In fact, it's not yet uniquely defined. Even though we have this beautiful formula, it's still not unique. And one way you can see that is it should make you nervous anytime you have an integral and there is a singularity exactly on the axis of integration. The bells need to go off in your head. This is not a uniquely defined integral. You have to make a decision how to handle the singularity. And that decision should be based on physics. Sorry, mathematicians, should be based on physics. Okay, so I'm going to evaluate this in spherical coordinates of K prime space. And choose the, whenever you have an integral over all angles, you can choose the z-axis however you like. I'm going to choose the z-axis of K prime space, in other words, the KZ prime axis. I'm going to choose it to lie along the r hat unit vector. So I'm lining up the z-axis with my r. For each different r I do the integral for, of course I'm going to do it for an integral number of r's, vectors, but for each one where I'm doing this integral, I'm free to pick the z-axis in K space along that vector. And one nice thing about that is that now we have axial symmetry in this dot product. And there is no k phi component in that dot product. Other words, we have independence of the phi k prime coordinate. And so we can rewrite our integral d cubed k prime as 2 pi for the phi k prime integral, and then a radial integral in k prime space, which looks like k prime squared dk prime, and then integral dx prime, where x prime is cos theta k prime, namely k prime dot r hat. And so k dot r here, right, that is equal to k prime r cos theta k prime, which is k prime r x, and we're integrating dx, or sorry, dx prime. So that first integral we've already done in phi, the second integral over x prime is also very simple. It's just an integral of an exponential. 4 pi over 2 pi squared k prime squared dk prime k prime squared over k prime squared minus k squared. Do I have too many k prime squared? I think I do. Sorry about that. You might correct your notes. Integral minus 1 to 1 dx prime of e to the I k prime r x prime. This is a really simple integral, e to the I k prime r minus e to the minus I k prime r over I k prime r. And so finally, we have just a one-dimensional integral, 4 pi over 2 pi squared, 0 to infinity dk prime k prime squared over k prime squared minus k squared e to the I k prime r minus e to the minus I k prime r over I k prime r. Okay, we're getting closer. We are down, we've boiled that 3D integral to a 1D integral. And I can rewrite that by multiplying here by 2 and here by 2. And then rewrite it in one more form as 2 over pi r integral 0 to infinity dk prime k prime over k prime squared minus k squared sine of k prime r. In the notes, this 2 was a 1, so you might check. Correct that in your notes if you've got a hard copy of them or a PDF copy. You could do that also. Okay, we still have to do this last integral, and we have to make it unique, which involves a little point of physics. You're admiring the beautiful equation? Okay, that's allowed. Okay, so this, notice it's an even function of k prime, because it's an odd function times an odd function of k prime with an even denominator in k prime. So we can rewrite it as an integral from minus infinity to infinity. That has some advantage, as we'll see in a moment, especially because we want to do this as a contour integral soon. We have the Green's function is 1 over I pi r. This integral now minus infinity to infinity dk prime of k prime over k prime squared minus k squared. And now I could write sine k prime r there. But I'm going to write e to the I k prime r. And the reason is because what I've done is I've added cosine of k prime r, which is an odd integrand and vanishes. So I've added 0 to this integral in order to put it in this form. And so now that is the form I want to evaluate and think about what it means. And And so again, this has this problem that we're integrating along the real k prime axis. We have a singularity at the point where k prime is equal to k. And so this integral is not unique. There are different ways of handling an integral where you have a singularity like that on the contour of integration, exactly on the contour of integration. And you might, if you're not very familiar with this fact, you might refer to like Arfkin and Weber as a pretty good reference. I think it's the fifth edition, section 7.2. So there are basically, when you have such a singularity, there are three standard ways to deal with it. And usually it would be nice if one of those three standard ways does what you want. We'll call these three interpretations of this integral. One is the principal value. You all know what principal value integral is, right? If you have like integral of a non-singular function, x minus x naught that has a pole, right? Then basically you've got a pole at x naught. You integrate up to just before the pole, then you skip over, go an equal distance just past, and continue integrating. And you take the limit as this distance you skipped goes to zero. That's the principal value version. Okay. That's a common way to handle such a singularity, to get a well-defined answer. A second way is to actually move the poles infinitesimally off of the axis. Into either the lower or the upper half plane. The complex plane I'm talking about. That's a second way. And a third way is to simply deform the integration contour so it doesn't actually hit the singularity. This will also give. You can decide whether to go above each pole or below each pole, but again, this also gives a definite answer once you've done that, although the different choices above or below will give different answers. Okay, so I'm going to, I guess, do the second method. You're going to miss the most exciting part. So I'm going to let k, remember we're doing all this integration for some fixed value of k, which is omega over c. So I'm going to let k get changed to k plus I times an infinitesimal real positive epsilon times I. And I'll consider what the integral becomes in the limit epsilon goes to zero through positive values. I'll indicate by epsilon goes to 0 plus. This means our two poles that are in that integral that are at k prime is plus or minus k, these now move to one pole at k prime is k plus I epsilon, and the other moves to minus k minus I epsilon. So I can indicate that on the complex plane, complex k prime plane. Here's the usual complex plot with the real part of k prime as our x-axis, imaginary part of k prime is our y-axis. And now k, the point where k prime is k plus I epsilon has shifted off the real contour here, the real axis, and the other pole where k prime is minus k minus I epsilon has shifted below. Okay. And our contour integral is still, it's along the real axis. Real values of k from minus infinity to infinity. That's our integral. With this choice of epsilon, it's now uniquely defined. And we want to change that into a contour integral so we can do this calculation using Cauchy integral methods. So I claim our integral now equals limit epsilon goes to 0 plus integral minus infinity to infinity dk prime k prime e to the I k prime r over, I'll write the denominator in a factorized way as k prime minus k minus I epsilon times k prime plus k plus I epsilon. And now I'm going to add another zero, which is integrating out to some like capital K and minus capital K, and then going on a semicircular arc to convert it into a closed loop integral. And the reason I can do it is this integral vanishes by something called Jordan's lemma. And Jordan's lemma says that such an integral vanishes if you have an exponential and you go up into the half plane where this is a decaying exponential, which it does is here because I went up into the upper half plane. If it was minus ik prime r here, I would have to go into the lower half plane to make it exponentially decay. And as long as you do that and the rest of the integrand is getting going to zero, doesn't matter how slow it goes to zero, but if the rest of it goes to zero at large distances from the origin, then this is justified that this part of the integral vanishes, and you're free to add it to make it a closed loop integral. And so now this looks like the limit as epsilon goes to zero plus, and the limit as the radius of that semicircle goes to infinity. And now we have a closed loop integral, dk prime, k prime, e to the I, k prime, r, over that k prime minus k minus I epsilon times k prime plus k plus I epsilon. And now that's the classic formula form, where I have an analytic function with one pole, simple pole, inside the contour. And we can use the Cauchy integral formula. To calculate it and get a final answer that's not even an integral, an exact explicit expression. So the Cauchy integral formula, let me remind you, says if you have a closed loop counterclockwise around a counterclockwise contour of an analytic function divided by a pole, by a denominator that vanishes, this is 2 pi I times the residue of the integrand at z naught. And that residue is simply 2 pi I, the non-vanishing denominator part of the integrand. So applying that here, says our Green's function is limit epsilon goes to 0 plus limit of k prime going to k plus I epsilon of k prime e to the I k prime r over k plus I epsilon times 2 pi I, which is just in the end I pi e to the IKR. Right, I've just been working on this integral, but the whole integral, if you remember, it's no longer on the board, was divided by I pi r. And so finally, g of r omega is just e to the I k r over r. So I know that took a bit of algebra and calculus and complex integral calculus to get there, but it's an incredibly simple result for this fundamental Green's function, the spatial part of the Green's function. But I should mention one other thing. Now, I said this is for one choice that moved the contour, the poles off the contour this way. If we had moved them the other way, like with a minus I epsilon, and then this would move here, if we had done that, I won't go through the algebra, we would have gotten a minus sign here in the exponent. So because of that, there are really these two standard choice possibilities, which I'll call g plus or minus, depending on which of those we decide is more physically relevant. And don't forget, k is omega over c. Is positive. And of course, r is the length of x minus x prime vector is positive too. But now, to decide which is more appropriate physically, let's remember what our time dependence was. it's e to the minus I omega tau as we set up our Fourier integral. And so that means that when you combine this with the e to the ikr, that the g plus solution corresponds to an outgoing spherical wave. Right, if you have e to the ikr minus I omega tau, then as time goes on, the wave fronts will move to larger and larger capital R values. And if, on the other hand, we had the g minus, this would correspond to incoming waves. So, unless we're in a universe that works like Back to the Future, hope you've all seen that movie. Usually we think we jiggle a charge, and at a later time, we will feel the effects of the fields at an observation point. And so we would normally want G plus. Somewhat surprisingly, G minus does come into some pretty fancy discussions, like Richard Feynman's PhD thesis. Sometimes you need these waves. These G plus is called the, maybe I'm not there yet. I need to put it all together in the time. But anyway, G plus we would call, for the spatial part, we'll call this the outgoing wave, spatial part of the Green's function, and G minus the incoming or ingoing wave, which is kind of weird. You have an observation point, and then you go and you find at a later time the charges jiggled to make that wave. Pretty weird. I'm just almost there. Do I have time? Do I have time? Maybe I should do it next time. We'll put in time and get the full time-dependent Green's function in all its glory. And we'll talk about what it all means for life, the universe, and everything.